So the emphasis on the spaciousness of mind, the stillness that contains or holds all our experiences in an unhindered way, is a different way of emphasizing meditation than we usually do with mindfulness. Mindfulness meditation is usually very simple, simply recognizing and noticing what's happening as it happens in the present moment. But the spaciousness of mind, spaciousness of awareness that knows what's happening, it can also be part of what we pay attention to. If I can notice this bell, and that's basically mindfulness, you notice something like a bell. The bell is here, seeing it. But the seeing itself has certain qualities. And it's the other half of the equation. There's the object that's seen, and there's the seeing of it. And the seeing, we tend to be focused so much on the object, we don't notice the other half, which is the seeing. And the nature of the seeing is independent of our desires or our fears or our aversions. The nature of seeing in itself is, some people would say, is peaceful or at rest or spacious. And some people then would say that the awareness which knows anything at all is always peaceful and at rest. However, within all the kind of functioning of the mind, the details of it, we can get quite preoccupied and constricted and contracted and aversive and resistant to all kinds of things going on. And it's kind of like we're living in a little, teeny little, kind of compressed up against a little corner of this huge, huge cathedral. And we're always looking down into the corner. And sometimes if you just turn around, you notice it's, wow, I'm in this amazing place. And then you can look back in the corner and it looks very different. So this evening I thought we would dedicate just to having questions, discussion, see what's on your minds, your concerns and questions about meditation, and we'll see where it goes from there. Leave it more open today. Yes, Ken.
You talked about concentrating or noticing on something besides the breath, maybe a sensation. And when I've tried that, I can't seem to deal with anything that doesn't have a tempo to it, because the breath has this tempo.
Uh-huh.
And so I've opened my eyes and looked at a tree, but it doesn't have I'm so used to the breathing. Could you talk more about focusing on on something besides the breath?
So I don't know if I've understood you, but you're saying that there's a certain rhythm to the breathing, and that rhythm keeps you connected.
Yes.
Whereas something which is a little more stationary, that it doesn't have any rhythm to kind of keep you engaged. That's interesting. It's possible that what we're trying to do in mindfulness is simply see things as they are without any kind of stickiness of mind to it. And it's possible that in emphasizing the rhythm of the breathing, you're kind of sticking, you're kind of savoring it, or kind of a little extra involvement with the breathing that's different than just being mindful in a very kind of plain, open way. So you might see if you can relax a little bit and just to be present for the particulars of the breathing as they occur and not the rhythm of it. Let go of the rhythm. And then you might be easier then to translate that into paying attention to other things. So if a sensation arises, an itch arises, or a feeling or something, then you can just see it for what it is and you can learn how to hang out with it without depending on a rhythm to keep you engaged.
And second question, can you meditate with your eyes open looking at something?
Sure.
When I picked a tree, like I say one time, you just look at the tree for a long time.
That's very great. And then as you're doing that, you want to be careful to notice the difference between contemplating the tree and maintaining the silent, non-discursive awareness of the tree. So probably the mind will start making, that branch looks like the Eiffel Tower, just seeing, without the associations. Yes?
I some reason found meditating on spaciousness, I found it much easier to keep from being carried away by the random thoughts that come in. I've never done that before.
Uh-huh.
It really worked for me.
Great, lovely. So whenever you find yourself drifting off in your thoughts, come back to the spaciousness, and then from that spacious place, be with your breathing. Could you do that also? Yeah, lovely. You stepped into the big cathedral. Said that everyone who engages in a meditation practice or a spiritual practice comes with a question. So what's your question? You can just sit there and not bring it forth. Yes?
A few weeks ago, Carlos said, you were talking about, I think, motion and feelings, and that we should recognize them and then accept them and then name them and then investigate. Could you talk a little bit more about how to investigate?
First, what it does not mean in terms of mindfulness practice is to analyze them. Or, like, you know, the usual way in the West, especially after 100 years of psychoanalysis, is to kind of, you know, they do more discursive investigation of them. The history of them, the reason for it there. The investigation we're talking about is more of a, like you're a naturalist from Mars, who's never seen an emotion before. And you're not interested, you don't even know there's a history to it. You're just interested, what is this immediate phenomena of emotion? What is that? What is it experienced like? So, and you want to just feel it, or sense it, or see it. So how does that emotion express itself in the body? Where in the body is it expressed? All emotions are expressed somewhere in the body, or manifest themselves in the body. The bodily part of it is part of the emotion. So where in the body do you feel it? And then to investigate the bodily component aspect of it is a very important part. If there are a lot of thoughts around an emotion, rather than investigating the thoughts, which is actually quite useful to do sometimes, but you investigate the feeling tone in the mind of having those kinds of thoughts connected to those kind of emotions. So that's the kind of thing we tend to investigate. And then as we hang out with it, just feel the emotion in the present moment. As we feel the physical parts of it in the present moment, or the felt sense in the mind in the present moment, we investigate what happens through time. What happens as we pay attention to it? Does it change? How does it change? And in mindfulness, we're very interested in noticing how things change as we're watching. Not that we try to make them change. We watch it. Now, emotions are interesting because they can either get stronger as you watch them, they can get weaker, they can stay the same for a while. And it's not our task to want them to go one way or the other. It's just, we just notice, oh, it's getting stronger, oh, it's getting weaker. So we investigate the changing aspect of the emotions. Investigation, I don't know if this is a nice analogy, but investigation in mindfulness, I think of as kind of like you're, is it called a spelunker? Spelunker? Spelunker, you know, he goes into a cave and spelunks around. I don't know what they do. I don't know why they have that name, but anyway, spelunker must spelunk. And but without any lights, you know, so it's just dark. And so she or he has to go around just kind of, you can't be, you're not thinking so much, you're just feeling your way. All your senses are alert and awake, and you're just kind of feeling your way through the dark. So in the same way with the emotions, you're not thinking about it, but you're just kind of feeling your way into them and sensing them and investing in them in that way. Is that helpful?
If I could, you had once said, but for another talk about when you looked at anger, for example, when you investigated it, it felt like disrespect. How did you get from recognizing anger to, that's just using it as an example,
right?
You felt that it was disrespectful. Well,
our ability to investigate something are varied. I don't want to say that you never do some kind of analytical investigation of things or contemplative, think about things and reflect on them that way. But when we're doing mindfulness meditation, we don't do that. You might do it usefully in other parts of your life. But in mindfulness meditation, if there's anger arises, we want to just be really present for the anger and kind of look at it carefully and feel it in the body, feel how it changes, and notice it. And as you do that, kind of in the cracks of the anger, you might notice some other emotion that's present, fear or hurt or something. And then when you notice you're not probing to find something beyond it. As soon as you're looking for something beyond what you're experiencing, you've lost your mindfulness. On mindfulness, we're only trying to be present for what's actually there. But as you're carefully present for what's happening in the present moment, something else might come up through the cracks of the present, and it might then be revealed in a different way. And it's fascinating with emotions because emotions, I'd like to say, are their nature is to be in motion. And as soon as you kind of bring this unhindering or unobstructive awareness of the emotion, its movement begins to move. And it can move, a kaleidoscope of different things can happen. Anger can move to rage, and rage can move to fear, and fear can move to terror, and terror can move to calm, and calm can move to peace. And you're just following along, you're along for the ride. In mindfulness, we're just along for the ride. Yes?
Do you think that meditating in any way can help a person, maybe me,
yes,
be one's own authority figure?
Oh, yes.
I have recently come up, lost all my authority figures, kind of almost all of them.
Oh, that's good.
And I started falling apart. And,
oh.
And feeling, and I didn't know that's what it was.
Temporarily, that may be very good, that you're falling apart.
And now I'm just at a place where I've kind of fallen apart because I don't want to have that attachment, you know, to these authority figures that they all should disappear at once, you know, that I, you know, and I know I do this, and I wondered if in meditation I could see myself as my own, my own authority.
Well, that's a great question, and that's a great process that's happening with you. It all sounds very healthy to me.
Oh,
oh, it's very healthy, but it's not pleasant.
I spent 3 weeks crying,
I can understand. The movement away from looking to other people as a source of your authority and what's right and wrong, can be very disorienting for a while, and very distressing. So you talked about falling apart. So that's kind of a normal part of that process for some people. So I would just take it as a, unpleasant.
You can use meditation to learn to trust yourself.
That's the whole point.
Oh.
That's really central to the whole Buddhist idea of spiritual practice, is to learn how to be your own authority. That's the whole, one of the main directions, one of the main things that needs to happen is you have to learn how to be your own spiritual authority for your own life. And one of the ways that it works is you start, as you become aware of your inner life, of your reactions, of your intentions, and of the consequences within you, then you find within yourself how to find out what is true and what is false. You don't have to depend on someone else to know what that is. You know what you like and what you don't like. You know how things affect you. You know how to speak from what's happening to you. If you're confused, you can speak with great authority. I'm confused. I know that I'm confused. And to really know that and to say it is a form of great authority, because no one else can take that away from you, something you really know for yourself. And then once you can really admit it and stand on that, then things will go a lot smoother. Oh, yes, and then you'll learn about a lot of what we learn in meditation. One of the things we can learn from mindfulness is to be very cognizant of our motivations. And the more aware we are of our motivations, the greater personal authority we'll have. Many people are kind of oblivious of their motivations, of why they do something or say things or act in certain ways. And if you're kind of oblivious of your motivations, then you're not really an authority of yourself. But once you become aware of your motivations, then you can take much more responsibility for your actions, which is the same thing as authority. The issue of authority, of course, is it maybe it's a little bit complicated because we have associations in our culture that maybe it means that we're full of knowledge and understanding, or full of worldly wisdom, or street smarts, or, you know, we understand about the great mysteries of spirituality or whatever. In Buddhism, we don't necessarily mean that. We just mean that we're the authorities of what is true for us in the present moment. And then we learn how to say that, and there's tremendous power in being true to what's happening to us in the present moment. Does that make sense?
That really makes sense. Because there are many times when I know that I don't want to do something or agree with something, and it just seems like a really good thing to go along with it. And recently I have also started doing that, saying what I really believe directly to the source.
Beautiful.
Instead of complaining to someone else about the source. And, you know, it's really different. It's, I'm working on it.
Beautiful. And there's a whole art, very important art, to learning how to speak in a way that is a non-violent way of speaking, a very respectful way of speaking, where we honestly say what's happening for us. So we're the only authority possible for what's happening to us inside of us. There's no one else in the world who can be as the authority. So when we start learning how to say, this is my experience, in a way that's not confrontative or blaming or attacking anyone else, then you'll start learning that the world will participate and cooperate with you much more than you maybe has in the past. But you don't give the world a chance to cooperate if the world doesn't know what your experience is. So in mindfulness, in a kind of a wise life based on mindfulness, there's first learning to be aware of what your own experience is. That's a big thing. The second thing, which is not necessarily part of mindfulness, but it's part of a wider spiritual life, is learning how to talk or explain or speak that experience to other people in a way that they don't take offense or they don't get upset and whatever, things like that. So in your situation, for example, you might not want to do something other people want you to do. One option you have is to very calmly say, I don't really feel like doing this. It doesn't feel right for me. I feel uncomfortable in this situation. I realize it's really important for you. I want you to know that I'm uncomfortable doing it. I'll do it anyway. But I want you to know how I'm feeling. That's one thing. There's a lot of things you might do, but the foundation of deciding is what to do is based on what your own experience is. And that allows other people to participate and allows you to participate with other people in a much more honest way. Because your interpretation, your reaction to certain events aren't always accurate. Right? So you're not necessarily the authority on the right interpretation of a situation. But you're the authority of knowing how you're reacting. And how you're reacting is a really important piece of information. And so then to step forward and say, this is my reaction to this experience. Then other people can say, well, I'm reacting this way, or my interpretation is this, or this way. And then you can have a dialogue back and forth. And sometimes you'll find that you saw the situation wrong. And sometimes you'll find the other person seeing it wrong, and you're right. But the point being, you're the authority of your reaction, not the authority of the interpretation. But if you can really take responsibility of your reaction, you'll find you can go through life with a lot more confidence. Making sense?
Yes.
Yeah, please become your own authority. And don't be too distressed that it's disturbing to let go of the old sources. Get some support, and I'm glad you brought it up. But everything you've said so far this evening sounds healthy. Go for it. Keep going in this direction. Yes?
The comment on the tree, looking at the tree, brought to mind my existentialism, and I wondered if there are similar processes in the thinking of existentialism in Buddhism. Do you see any, or can you comment on that?
It's been so long since I studied existentialism, I don't think that I remember very well the philosophy. But what I vaguely remember, it could be wrong, is that in the thinking of Sartre, for example, that there is no meaning in the world except what we create for ourselves. Is that right?
Well, I think so. I'm thinking back to, the novel *The Nausea*, and the man looking at the tree.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't remember this. So the analogy, I don't know what to do about. But if this the thing I brought up about, that we make a meaning for ourselves, that there's no meaning in life, only what we make of it. Some Buddhists would say this, would agree with that, to some degree that's true. But Buddhists, I think Buddhist practice wants to go deeper than that. And there's two directions of going deeper. One is to question the very need for meaning. Many people think that the search of meaning is a very worthwhile thing to do in life. I'm not going to say it's not. But very few people will step back, turn the mirror back on the search itself and say, where does the search for meaning come from? Where does the need for meaning come from? And that's what Buddhist practice asks you, to look back at the need for meaning and clarify that. And if you clarify that, you might find you don't need any meaning. Yes?
I have, over the course of the time I've been here, followed the same thing. And this image of looking at the chestnut, right? But you see it as though directly, as though you've never, ever seen it before. Yeah. I used to, when I was a child, I remember looking at a brass hook in my closet long before I knew anything about art, as though I'd never seen it before. And it's a strange experience. And I've often heard you talk about seeing directly without the mind interpreting, just letting it come. It seems to me that it is that same sort of amazing experience when that happens, to see something in that immediate way.
Right. Yes. Quite so. So if that's the connection to existentialism, yeah, that's great. That it's possible to see something without all the associated ideas and history and all that we bring with it. And just see something really cleanly and in the present moment, and it's a beautiful thing, beautiful way of living. Yes?
Actually, when that happens, I mean, the thing sort of loses its normal meaning. You see it entirely differently. It's just a thing. It's not a close-up, but it's sort of mind-boggling.
Beautifully said. Mind-boggling, yeah.
Isn't it interesting that memory has stayed with her so long? I mean, it's interesting that when you do see something, it just never leaves.
Yes?
I was just wondering whether Buddhism thinks that there is a purpose in each person's life, and that has, I'm not sure whether it's linked to the meaning of life. I think maybe they're separate, really, the meaning of life. Sounds like a universal thing, what is life? But what about an individual's purpose in life? I know that some people, and certainly I speak for myself, that I've always been looking for a purpose in my life, and I haven't found it. And I'm just wondering if Buddhism talks about a purpose in life, or whether it doesn't, and whether, if it does, whether meditation can help a person find the purpose in their life.
Well, the first half of that, does Buddhism talk about a purpose of life? I'm not really actually so familiar with any place and clear discussion of such an issue in Buddhism. Doctrinally, Buddhism tends to look at the momentum of our life and where we're going as being a result of our karma. So it's a karmic momentum rather than a purpose. So it's kind of like we're being pushed from the back, as opposed to, you know, looking for something in the future where we're going, like a vision. What I've noticed is that some people seem to find something they call the purpose of their life, a thing that they're doing, some occupation, some vocation, something that they do that really seems to be their purpose. And other people never find such a thing, and they feel a bit oppressed because in our culture around here, there's a high premium on finding your thing. But some people, it's not in the cards for them to find their thing. What it is for them is how they do something is more important than what they do. And so they find their happiness in how they do their lives, how they do something, how they do their particular job they ended up with or whatever. And that's where they find their fulfillment, not in finding the right whatever. The right job, the right spouse, the right whatever, but how they engage with what's happening around them. And that can be a great relief for some people. You say, oh yeah, that's what I'm all about. I'm about the how, not the what. And how, the how-ness of life is actually much more important, I think, from the spiritual practice point of view than the what we do, for the, you know, as a generalization. I think many people have found a sense of purpose through a meditative discipline, because as we learn to quiet down all the surface chatter of the mind and the surface inhibitions and fears, and then it allows for some deeper voice or some deeper sensitivity inside of us to express itself, or us to be in touch with it. And then we find a deeper values that we want to live from, or deeper inspirations we want to live from that aren't accessible so much when we're kind of on the surface chatter of things. So I've known lots of people who, for example, have gone off on retreat, sometimes for 10 days, sometimes for 3 months, and sometimes longer, for the very purpose of finding out what they want to do with their life. And they're hoping by really getting away from the normal life and get far from it, and letting their mind be really quiet, they can listen deep inside to what some inner voice might want to say. And the last thing to say about purpose, it's a little bit hard to say because I don't want to say it as being some kind of absolute, but from the point of view of Buddhism, there are two, I mean, I don't know if this is true, but it's kind of like, from the point of view of Buddhism, there's two ultimate purposes, of at least for Buddhist practice, which some people devote their whole life to. And one purpose is liberation. And there's almost a biological imperative within us to be freed from all that binds us, to be released from all the clingings and tightenings of the heart and constrictions and fears that we have. It's almost like a biological imperative. And if we kind of sense that biological imperative, you'll find a tremendous motivation to go in the direction of freedom and do the practices, do what it takes to kind of go become free. So liberation is one of the great purposes of Buddhist practice is ultimately about. The other one is, the other ultimate purpose is compassion, is to try to help support other people to do the same, to help other people suffer less, to free, help other people become liberated. And these historically have been the two driving purposes of Buddhist spiritual life. People who devote their life, you know, in a professional way or whatever, serious way, fully to a Buddhist life, is they're pursuing those two things: liberation and for themselves, and liberation for others. And then there's an interesting interplay between the personal and the social. There's a balance between them that has to happen. Some Buddhists emphasize a lot more the compassion side of going out and being supportive of others, and some Buddhists tend to focus much more on their own inner liberative process. But the two are really entangled with each other. Does that make sense? Yes?
Does Buddhism offer guidelines on how to be supportive or helpful to other people?
Oh, just tons of them, yeah.
For example, somebody comes to you with who's upset about something and just sort of wants to talk or is seeking advice on something.
Well, I think a lot of what Buddhism would say in that situation probably just common sense, you know. The common sense things to do would make it, which is really helpful. The compassionate thing to do is often just listen to a person, and listening is really helpful in many different ways. If someone was really interested in Buddhist practice, then if there was permission for it, you might help the person probe or point to some of the deeper underlying attachments or world views or self-identities the person has appropriated for themselves. It seems to underlie and fuel the upsetness. So to use the mindfulness or to investigate deeper and where is the person stuck? But you don't want to do that with your normal friends because, you know, mostly what they want to support. You don't want to kind of be, you know, probing. But from a Buddhist practice, when it's done thoroughly, is meant to get down to the roots of our self-identity, roots of our clinging, roots of our attachments. And a lot of the ways when we get upset is because we haven't really dealt with those roots. So from a strict Buddhist point of view, we want to get down to those roots. So you can go to a good therapist and be heard well, or a good friend and be heard well. And Buddhists, hopefully, as a good Buddhist, you've learned how to listen really well and learn how to not be reactive and how to be compassionate and kind to your people, to your friends. But but the ultimate purpose of Buddhism from that, you know, is to really get down there to the roots. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It sounds like I understand my place is not to do that probing.
Then your place is to be compassionate and do the compassionate thing. When I was first starting to do a lot of Buddhist meditation, I had a lot of understanding. It became very quickly obvious to me the ways in which I and others operated on, back then we called it kind of ego trips, right? We had all the ego trips we were on. And as I became more aware of them through my mindfulness practice, in myself and in others, I no longer wanted to participate in them, in myself, and I didn't want to support other people to have them. So that was kind of the wisdom side of Buddhism. So I had a girlfriend at the time who needed a lot of, she called them strokes, she wanted her ego kind of propped up all the time. And I was very sensitive to this need of hers. And being a new practitioner, I was all inspired about not doing that, and so I kind of stayed aloof from that part of her. And so that relationship didn't last very long. Many years later, I kind of was remembering back at that time, and I realized that I had a certain amount of good wisdom and understanding, but what I lacked was compassion. And so, you know, I regret, you know, that I wasn't able to meet her. You know, she was suffering. That's why she was playing out those ego trips and why she had those needs. And I could have met her at her suffering instead of just avoiding her, right? So my compassion hadn't been developed yet. That came later in my practice. The wisdom came first, and then later I had to learn compassion. So what you're asking is a big, big question. And we could spend all, you know, weeks talking about it. But I'll tell you the first reaction I had to when you brought it up. I was reminded of a story that the Buddha told of two acrobats who one would stand on the shoulders of the other and do acrobatic tricks. And so they're about to do some show, and the one who was going to be standing holding the other said, I'll watch you, and watching you, I'll protect myself. And the guy who was going to be on top said, no, don't do that. You watch yourself, and in watching yourself, you'll protect me. So there's a way in which sometimes the best way of a powerful way of supporting others in their difficulties is to be really mindful of ourselves, so that we don't react in unhealthy and unuseful ways, And if we really take care of ourselves and watch ourselves really carefully, that becomes a protection for and a support for the others. Yes?
Bill, could you expand on that comment you made about being pushed by our karmic past? Usually the Western, or I've been kind of like goal driven by something in the future to obtain, and your comment about being, you know, pushed by a karmic force from behind is kind of turns that around. I'd like to have you explain that to me.
We're not predetermined by our karma, but we're powerfully conditioned by it. So a lot of people who are not reflective about their choices in their life are just being carried along by their habits and their habit reactions. And so if you've set up, for example, a habit of, and not you necessarily, but someone has set up a habit of always responding angrily, that becomes a powerful habit, and then the person's kind of being almost like it becomes like it's really, really easy to be angry the next time you come into a difficult situation, because it's like that's what's ready at hand. What Buddhism says is that the intentional choices we make, when we choose, when we have an intention for something and we intend a certain result, that intention has a consequence in our inner life. Our karmic consequences has to do with the cause and effect relationship in our inner life. So for example, two people could start a business together, but they have very different, and they go through all the same actions together. They kind of do everything as partners. They're doing everything together. One of them, but they have different intentions. One of them's intention is to make as much money as possible, and the other one's intention is to create a company where the best in the workers comes out, where they feel a strong sense of community, a strong sense of support for each other, where the best in the workers can come out, and so the workers can feel fulfilled for being in that place. The money is not so important for the second one. So that's nice. The company fails after 5 years. Both partners go through the failure. But the ways in which those two partners experience the failure could be very different. The person who wanted money set up a whole momentum where disappointment was going to be a really strong possibility if they failed. And the person's really disappointed. The person who wanted to create a healthy work environment might be disappointed because the work environment dissolves, but might look back at those 5 years and say, yes, but in those 5 years, we had a really fantastic family feeling. And we really support each other, and all the best came out of us. And I feel really, really fulfilled for having had those 5 years, because we created this wonderful work environment, which I've never had in any business that I've ever been in before. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So the person who had the intention. So intentions can have huge. Intentions can have different consequences. Intentions can be very consequential. So in Buddhism, so we have to look at our intentions. The Buddha said that it's our intentions which create our karmic momentum. And so if you're constantly wanting more money, then there's a momentum of greed which is set in motion. And that momentum of greed, unless you do something to help kind of extract yourself from it, will all too easily keep moving and moving through you. And so, so you kind of always going into the next situation looking, what can I get from that? I don't think I'm explaining it very well, but so a lot of our conditions in the present of who we are conditioned by our past choices. And in order to become free of that, we have to start looking at the choices we make in the present moment. So the present moment is very important, not only for mindfulness, but for wise living. Because we have to make, we have to really enter into the present moment carefully to see clearly what is our motivation right now for why we're choosing to do something. And then if we can choose wisely, then there's an opportunity to break the momentum of the past. Yes?
You were talking about attachments.
Yes.
What do you mean by attachments?
My wife for a while belonged to a group called Bay Area Attachment Parenting, where attachment meant something really good. You know, the child sleeps sleeps in the family bed, and attachment, and often in the West, it can mean kind of a bonding or kind of affection or can have very positive connotations. Buddhists, when they use the word attachment, are not negating that kind of English use of it. But Buddhists have a very particular meaning. When Buddhists use the word attachment, they always have a negative spin on it. They're not denying the other uses of it. And the negative spin is it's synonymous with clinging or craving. And clinging is considered to be a great problem in Buddhism, because when you cling to something, after a while your fingers hurt. And Buddhists don't want to hurt. Make sense? So it's a clinging, which is a clinging is basically
unhealthy attachment, I guess.
Yeah, Buddhists use the word attachment, they mean unhealthy attachment. So you have to be a little patient with these Buddhists when they use that word. You have to that was Buddhist. You know, they have a particular meaning. Yes.
I had a question about a technical question about the actual practice.
Great.
I feel like there's this fine line between awareness and being aware of what's going on in the present moment and stepping over into the analysis side. And it's almost like, for me, it's the difference between being nonverbal and verbal, or your mind being nonverbal and verbal. So I'll sit there trying to be aware, and then awareness is actually taking on a verbal quality. It's
great.
Saying, you know, what am I aware of? All these words bubbling up.
Great.
And then you're thinking, right? So, I'm thinking now. I want to get away from thoughts to be aware, and then this little cycle begins. So I have this little fence of trying to stay on the nonverbal side of awareness.
Right. If I can reword what you said, I think there's a big difference between analysis and non-discursive awareness, awareness practice of mindfulness. But there is a fine line, or maybe no line really, a shade between verbalizing and verbal and non-verbal forms of awareness. When your mind becomes really still and feels, from some point of view, basically nonverbal, just aware in a direct way, Buddhism actually says you cannot get to a place of pure awareness without any verbalization at all, without any cognition at all. Though, compared to how we normally are, the mind is completely still. So empirically, almost, it can feel like a big difference. But in the very subtle analysis of how the mind works, there is a very, very, very subtle level of cognition going on all the time. So even though that wonderful tree that Sartre saw, he's not seeing it through the filter of associations and history and memory, and it's just this amazing thing, tree arising, but still it's a tree. Or maybe it's not a tree, but it's just green. And there's this very... But that the very, very subtle movements of cognition within the mind, in order to see that, the mind has to be phenomenally concentrated and still. So it can be a little bit confusing. Now, different people... I've had this conversation with a number of very you know, senior Vipassana teachers. And some of them report that in their deepest realms of meditation they go to, some of them will report that there's no thoughts at all. And some of them report that there's a very, very, very simple thoughts, almost like half sentences, recognizing, oh, a sound, oh, an itch. And when I brought those two people, those kinds of people together, they kind of look at each other in amazement and say, really? You had that experience? That's how it was for you? So empirically it can be, people can have different experiences of relative or absolute silence of the mind with awareness. But compared to the way most people are, it gets pretty silent in there. It's non-discursive awareness. So I call it non-discursive awareness as opposed to non-verbal. Because non-discursive is talking about it. Verbal means you can still have simple words of cognition.
So would naming be a very simple verbal part of sound?
Right. So when we do the noting, which was part of the... it's not an essential part of the mindfulness practice, the noting or the naming of the experience. But it's a very helpful aid to the practice. And one of the ways that naming is very helpful is that it certainly simplifies the thinking process. It's kind of like using our thinking to really help us be present for what's happening. And naming are kind of like siblings almost. So you're getting closer to that through the naming. And some people at some point will drop the noting. So now if this doesn't make any sense for you, if it confuses you, just forget everything about I said now. But in the subtlety of Buddhist psychology, it said you cannot become free of cognition unless you have there's a couple of very rare experiences that can happen where cognition does not happen, but in all the normal states of awareness, normal states of meditation, cognition is a part of it. Yes?
When I think I'm quieting down, which is nowhere near silent, I think I'm on the right track because I start to see blue kind of in the center. When you said, like, lower your eyes and kind of rest, and you know, the longer that happens, I see blue. And then I thought, I don't know whether I'm supposed to hold on to the blue and say, yes, blue, you know, or what. But I always think it's a positive thing. For me, it's a sign that something's happening anyway. But and then the other thing is that when you use the bell, it's a nonverbal way that I use to become nonverbal. It's like it's a clue, and all of a sudden, everything stops. It's like I can't think when you're playing the bell.
Nice. So maybe we'll do this one evening. There's a whole meditation, bell meditation, called the Big Mind Meditation, which is very helpful in that way. And from the discursive place most of us are at, this cuts through that discursiveness quite dramatically, and it's very helpful. Now about the blue. Generally, seeing colors in meditation is considered a good sign. You can feel happy about it happening. But it doesn't happen to everyone, but it happens to some people. They see colors. Some people see patterns when they meditate. So you can take it as a good sign, but it's never something to hold on to. It's never something to try to make happen. It's never something to try to prolong. It's never something to kind of indulge in. It's just something to notice and let it go right through you, just, you know.
It doesn't mean anything, you know, like if you said red roses, it's supposed to mean love or anything. I don't know. I don't understand how to mean it.
I'm not going to say it doesn't have a meaning for you, but what I will say is that generally, it's not always the case, but generally, I don't know if it's the meaning exactly, but the condition or the cause for seeing colors or light of various kinds in meditation is that the mind is getting calm and concentrated. So it's just, so it's, in that sense, it's a good sign of developing concentration and calm. But you don't want to get hold on to it in any way. You don't want to get involved in assigning meaning to it, or you know, patting yourself on the back and say, "Oh, great," you know. Or, you know, you just want to kind of continue with a very simple, matter-of-fact awareness. Oh, seeing. I'm just seeing blue. It's like, you know, big deal. And you just keep going. So last one, and then we'll sit briefly. Stephanie.
I was just going to say the bell, too, for me. It was interesting because you said this is a bell, and we can look at it and say it's a bell. But the ringing of the bell filled the space. It created the spaciousness for me. And it's the same with music. It's immediately, or listening to a foreign language and understanding it. It's direct. It's just a direct connection.
Sure. And what we're trying to do in mindfulness is not to depend on any props for that direct connection, but learn how to do it on our own, because in any given time and place, any given experience. So let's do it. So we'll sit for about 4 minutes. Our hearts do not need anything to be peaceful. May your mindfulness practice show you how little you need for your hearts to be at peace. So thank you all, and I wish you a wonderful and happy week.